Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, White Sox fans, Brett Ballantini here hosting Dish Deluxe. It's our history podcast. Dish Deluxe is number 6. And after a 2023 season like we've experienced and a 2023 year like we've all experienced as White Sox fans, of course, it's appropriate. We just can't get out of the quicksand that is how bad it is to be a White Sox fan. And this podcast is specifically going to attend to really amusing about what the worst year of White Sox fandom may be. There are a number of contestants for it. I am lucky enough. This is the first in, say, 500 or so Southside Sox, Sox Populi, Southside Hip Pen, whatever other different guises we've used to do podcasts, probably 500 or so, where I can say this is the first time I am the junior member of this podcast group. I've talked with Lee plenty of times. I talked with Mark, but those were, you know, more one-on-ones or not with the group. These are my two White Sox papas on the site, and I'm lucky enough to have Lee Allen, the, of course, the duty geezer of the site, and our site historian as well, Mark Liptak. He's done some of these Dish Deluxes with me already. This is Lee's first time on the Dish Deluxe History Podcast and on our little StreamYard whatchamajigger thing that we're using here to do these podcasts. Before we get into it, and listen, to talk about, I mean, if it's any sort of statement on the I can't speak to what these guys are doing later on. I'm on the East Coast, so I'm ahead of everybody else here. But the three of us on a Friday night, an early Friday evening, are going to be sitting around, spending an hour or so talking about the worst year in White Sox fandom history, if that tells you anything about our respective social lives. Mark's very busy with his broadcasting. Lee's got travel coming up and whatnot. He's always got stuff going on and writing entertaining pieces for us on Southside Sox. Column every week. Got another one coming. Oh, I don't know. Maybe with this podcast. So first off, welcome to both of you. And the
Thank
first
you.
Thing I want to do
Pleasure here to be here.
With this fanciness is we are going to go with, it's the gut check, guys. It is definitely on the short list of worst years ever to be. Whether it turns out to be the worst or not, I'm not even going to reveal my answer yet, although it's very tempting. 2023 has been a horrible year. And so in both of your cases, I would like to get an idea of just where you are as a White Sox fan, a gut check, if you will, about where your fandom stands. Because I'll answer my own question and I'll continue to not let you guys talk by just saying, listen, I don't know if I've had this combination of hopelessness and discussed with the team really ever before. And there have been low points, and there's been points where I've had some disgust, threatening to move to Florida, let's say. But I don't know that I've had this combination. And you might say, why am I doing this? Why are we doing this? But, it's fandom, I guess. So where are both of you at in terms of just how you're feeling as White Sox fans?
Who do you want to start first, Brett?
Oh, gosh, just
go with it, Mark.
You pick the short straw, Mark. Give it to us.
It's very difficult right now, guys. The hope factor does not seem to be there. For example, they were really bad, let's say, in 1987, 1988, 1989, but they had a crop of kids coming up. Yeah. You did not expect them to do as well as they did in 1990 that soon, but at least you could say, okay, Frank Thomas is coming, Robin Ventura is coming, Jack McDowell is coming, Alex Fernandez is coming. I just don't see that right now with this organization. I've used the three words in the past, folks, and unfortunately, I've got to use them again. This organization from the top down is incompetent, dysfunctional, and inept. And that simply will not change until new ownership arrives. If there is any hope, that's the hope. Sooner or later, new ownership has to arrive, and maybe things will start to get back on the upswing then. At least that's my feeling right now.
Well, I during the course of the season, when I watch a game or even just look online and make some kind of comment out loud, my wife repeatedly says, "Why are you still a fan?" I mean, she must have said that to me 200 times this year, because also our son is a big fan too, and I'm indoctrinating grandchildren, our daughter's children.
It's hard right now.
Well, it's habit. It's ingrained. It's in your blood. You can't get it out. It's there. Will and I, his son and I, actually at one time in the late 90s, when they got Albert Bell, and also had Frank Thomas and his whiny face. I don't know if you remember that, but boy, the late 90s, he just whined about everything. And when they did that, we came to the conclusion, it's one thing to root for a team that's not very good, and it's another thing to root for a team that's a bunch of jerks, which, of course, we've got going for us this year. Yes. So, let's try back. So we actually started looking at where could we go to be fans of another team. And we were living at that time in Ohio. In Southern Ohio. And Dayton, I could never quite make myself be a Reds fan. So we were looking around all these places and decided, well, there's a new team in Tampa Bay. That'd be a good place to go watch games because, vacation paradise. Yay. So we went down there and we spent a weekend of the first year of the Rays, Devil Rays. And we went down there and watched four games against the Yankees. Which, incidentally, the stands were absolutely chock full of Yankees fans because that's where they play their spring ball. And they were the most evil people I'd ever seen in my life. But I already knew Yankees fans were absolutely evil and horrible. The Yankees won all four games, and we left and went, it's a nice place to visit, but we don't want to live here. We don't want to go with this. So we dropped them. Yeah, I mean – but that was a very temporary thing, and we came right back. I don't know when you come back. I'm with Mark. It's Mark and I are old people. It's one thing for young people to go, well, if you're only, kind of off the planet. For us old people to go, well, if another old guy would just, things would be all right. It's strange. But, yeah, I'm with Mark. I think there's no hope. The whole that we have this alleged loyalty thing. I don't think there's any loyalty to Jerry Reinsdorf. I think it's getting his butt kissed is what it's all about. And that's what he's always going to come back to. And that's the only factor that's important to him. And of course, saving money and not paying any taxes. But yeah, it's a very depressing time.
It's a point.
I will say, because I know this has come up, in various places. Would you root for another team? Would you root for the Cubs? Yada, yada.
No.
I would never do that. I mean, if something were to happen to the White Sox franchise as a franchise, I would just watch baseball, but I certainly would not be a fan of the Cubs. And I basically would not be a fan of anybody. Now, I don't think it's reached that point yet. Yet. Yeah. But as Lee was saying, as Brett has said, it's really a rough time right now on a lot of fronts. And you
that he moved to Los Angeles and gets to hang around Dodger Stadium a lot. So he's got another team to go with, even though they're a little sad at the moment, but not to the same degree as the White Sox. I'm sure they have much more hope. But yeah, as you said, Mark, there's nothing. I mean, horrible defense, horrible offense, horrible pitching, no farm system whatsoever. I mean, you got one or two guys down there who might make major leaguers, Wilson Montgomery and who else after that?
Brian Ramos, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. But he apparently is only a third baseman where we're already got somebody sitting there. And we
just for 1 year.
But we just traded away our best hope there, where suddenly caught fire and became a superstar when he left. And then, of course, you know, again, if Mark was talking about the whole dysfunction of the organization, it's just absolutely incredible.
Let me ask you both, without taking this too much off the rails and delaying the notion of actually choosing this worst year ever, we'll get to it, promise all you dedicated listeners. But this is something I brought up many times, just simply crosstown wise. I mean, there's no way to not frame your fandom in a two-team city without incorporating the Cubs. And as much as Cubs mm-hmm. fans likes to try to deny it, there's no way for them to do it either. Of course, it's natural. It's not an obsession. It's just there's two teams in town. And with a lot of the, well, as I've already explained, basically everybody I talk to on these podcasts are usually considerably younger fan than even I. It's a situation, though, that only recently it seems to be that there's actual, you start to get the feeling of almost, I'll use the word shame, it might not be the right word, about the younger White Sox fans who maybe have only known the rebuild can more easily dismiss and say, oh, that's the White Sox, that they're a punchline. I've resisted that even into the rebuild talking that way, because one of the things that always made me proud to be a White Sox fan is they were more frequently competitive, even though maybe in the long run they didn't maybe win a division any more than, say, the Cubs did or most other teams did. There's something about the competitiveness. There's something about not being cellar dwellers, lovable losers. And again, not that my fandom is framed just as, you know, in the context of the Cubs, but to me, that was always a distinction between the two teams. That's a distinction I can't make any longer. In fact, it's probably, aside from the absolutely, absolutely amoral ownership and the mollification of that ballpark, I think actually the Cubs and Cubs fans would be slumming to say they're in the same category as the White Sox right now, because look at how far our team has fallen, both on the field and really off. Am I speaking to something that makes any sense as White Sox fans longer than I've been, of there was a chip that you could carry that just said, listen, I'm a baseball fan. I appreciate watching at least somewhat more often than not decent baseball. I'm not a mm-hmm. lovable loser, et cetera. That's something that seems to have been eroded in the Han era, where now I can't even.
What decent baseball are you talking about? Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, right. Yeah. So, I mean, is this something I've created, or is there some foundation in our fandom that would not make it as quickly a punchline as it is definitely today?
Let me say two things. First off, regarding the Cubs, Brett, the Cubs were a punchline on late night mm-hmm. talk shows for a half a century.
Absolutely.
The White Sox, at least, have not gotten there yet. Again, I use that in quotes, yet.
Yeah.
And I think the word that you're looking for, Brett, is not shame necessarily, but embarrassment. Mm. I think that's a better word right now. This is a major market, and I know people say, well, okay, it's a split market, but it's still Chicago. It's still the third biggest market in the country. Even half of that market is bigger than the vast majority of major league markets right now. There is no excuse, and I think Lee will will agree with me on this. There is no excuse not to field a competitive team, period. It doesn't mean you're going to win every year, okay? It doesn't mean you're going to go to the playoffs every year. But there is no reason in the world why the White Sox cannot at least have a winning season, even if it's just 82 games. They did it from 1951 to 1967. I realize baseball has changed since then, but the White Sox are not exactly a poor franchise. They can do it if they want to, and that's the key, if they want to.
Now, neither one of you guys live in Chicago.
Correct.
I live about a mile and a half from Wrigley Field. Until 10 years ago, I lived closer and used to walk by, if not Wrigley itself, well, yeah, usually Wrigley itself, but certainly the Clark Street area on my way to work. And I would be stepping carefully around the frat boy puke that was left over from the Cubs game. That does not endear you to their fandom in any way, shape, or form. Now, one thing I've noticed, and I really noticed from way back, Sox fans, by and large, are baseball fans.
Correct.
There may not be on the same level as, I know St. Louis has the reputation of being really expert fans, but they're baseball fans. They care about baseball. They're there for the game. And they know pretty much how the game is played and what's good or bad about any particular procedure. Not true of Cubs fans. Cubs fans go there just for some reason, drink $16 beers when they can have the same beer for $2 on the other side of the street. And then you know, do what they do on the sidewalks. So that is part of the anti-Cubdom, but it just grows. You don't have to hate the Cubs, but you have to not like them. you picked one lane, and there are people in Chicago who say, "Oh, I like both teams." Well, there are people who do, but they're not usually big baseball fans. They're just being nice Chicago people. Mm-hmm. It's White Sox. I mean, never. If I picked another team to be a fan of, it could never, ever, ever, ever be the Cubs. Not quite as bad as the Yankees, but damn close. Plus, as you mentioned, that we think we've got a god-awful owner. That family, whoa. Yeah.
But the notion that we could carry a chip that says the White Sox aren't a punchline, and I understand there's been plenty of low points, et cetera, and you know, the disco demolition or, you know, whatever. You know, there's always low points for any team. But the notion that it's almost part and parcel with your fandom that you're a punchline. I mean, I used to bristle up, you know, routinely. I still do, except now I got to realize, oh, all right, don't speak, don't type, because what are you going to say? What grounds do you have to really object to any crack about the White Sox? And even just a few years ago, you could still stand up and say, hey, that's a cheap shot. Hey, they forgot the 2005 World Series again. And so at this point, I mean, you guys will agree that it's getting harder and harder to have any sort of take any offense to any crack made at the White Sox, because at this point, this team deserves it. I mean, we're the ones leading, I think.
I take no offense. Yeah. No, and if I'm wearing a Sox gear walking down the street and somebody goes, yay, Sox, I'll go, yeah, someday.
No, yeah. I would have to agree with that, Brett. The criticism is deserved. Mm-hmm. The criticism is deserved.
Yeah. All right, we are going to actually get into discussing some White Sox history now, even though, let's face it, with the three of us, look at us, come on, we're just oozing White Sox history and every, you know, every word we speak. Okay, listen, we're specifically going to address, because this podcast sort of, the genesis was in reading Lee's piece from about maybe a month ago, addressing the 1970 season, what steps, I think specifically more what steps were taken from that season to change things. I think that season proved, though you might not have known it then, more hopeful based on changes made that we have not seen in 2023. So the parallels may end there. I want you both, if you can, to speak to your experiences there. And then to be honest here, because we know how it turned out, because things took a pretty quick upturn. But at the time, even as, let's say, Roland Hemo was hired at the end of the season, or Chuck Tanner was the manager change. Who was Chuck Tanner? I also want to know from both of you, how much hope you did feel with that. If it was just like, well, this is a wait and see. I can't imagine that September 1970, you're like, okay, well, here we go. It's going to get a lot better soon. But can you both just speak to the experiences of the 1970 season and really 68, 69, and 70 leading up? Because that really is the bottom point in terms of a consecutive three seasons mm-hmm. in White Sox history. What was it like?
Well, Mark, I'm going to go first, Mark, because you sure. know more than I do. I was not a White Sox fan at the time. In 1970, I was stationed in Cyprus. So I occasionally saw ball scores if I got hold of the AP wire. I came to Chicago in 70. And the only time I'd ever been to Chicago in my life before that was to go to boot camp at Great Lakes. So that was not a natural fandom for me. I came during the 1971 season to go to school at UC and in graduate school, and I found out in graduate school, you got to study. I said, to hell with that. I'm not doing that. And my brother worked part-time for this little radio station in Evanston that ended up as the White Sox home station because they yes. lost their big stations from 1970. Yes. They lost everything after 1970. And they were looking for a guy to travel with Harry Carey, which was one of the improvements they made as far as getting back in public eye, and do engineering. And I was a broadcast engineer. And I went to that station and I asked for that job. It's a union job. He said, yeah, you got nobody else wanted it. Yeah, okay, you'll be all right. And then one of the guys broke up with a girl in the office and he decided he wanted it. I got his job. So I was there in the station plugging patch cords in merrily during that season. But it was 71 I followed because I came in the middle of the season. 72, the great season, that's when I was actually in the press box on occasion and doing those kind of things. So I don't have the background that goes back through 68 and 69. But one thing I want to bring in is, well, we're on this because I was looking up all kinds of things from them. Total war, was about the same as this year. And I'm using the wars before. It was within the 10th. Louis Aparicio, 4.8. Bill Melton, 2.5. On the pitching side, Tommy John, of course, Wilbur Wood, way up there. And most of the rest, kind of negative. But one thing I looked was, because I love defense. Defensive efficiency, they were dead last, as the Sox have been for many years now. Dead last in 1970. But strangely, 65 to 67, they were first in the majors in defensive efficiency, mm-hmm. according to Baseball Reference. That's an amazing collapse because they had a lot of the same people. Louis Aparicio was still there. They traded him away, and what was not a good trade, but he was still there.
They did not have the same people. Remember, they traded Don Buford. They traded Tommy Agee. They traded Al Weiss. They traded Tommy McGraw. I'm not saying you're necessarily wrong. I'm just saying there was a major turnover after that 1967 season. I think that's part of the reason why your defensive efficiency rating bottomed out. A lot of their really good defensive guys, a lot of their speed guys, both offensively and defensively, were gone.
Yeah. Well, Mark, then chime in now on as someone who got to enjoy the spoils of never having a losing season, suddenly having them hit you in the forehead in 68 and just being relentless through 69 and even to 70, to the point where maybe you even started to question your allegiance because it had to get really bad.
I never went quite that far. But Lee brings up some very good points. It was very strange because the White Sox not only had some good players, which is part of the reason they were able to rebuild so quickly, because Roland Heeman and Chuck Tanner were actually able to get quality back for people like Luis Aparicio and Ken Berry. They had some likable players, Aparicio, Berry, Tommy John, Wilbur Wood, Bill Melton, Carlos May. They didn't pitch very well. The defense was horrible in 1970. To me, it was a difficult situation because of all the outside things that were happening. it was bad enough on the field. They lost 106 games in 1970, but consider everything else that was going on. Comiskey Park was falling into disrepair. The Cubs were very good, which took a great amount of media coverage away from the White Sox, which was completely different from what was happening between 1951 and 1967, when the White Sox got the lion's share of the media coverage, both locally and nationally. The threats of moving. Yep. Art Allen had a handshake agreement with Bud Selig to move the team to Milwaukee. In fact, they had played some regular season games in Milwaukee as kind of a test.
And got huge attendance
in Milwaukee. And what people may not know is they had a handshake agreement, and it was John Allen, Arthur Allen's brother, who said, if you want to move the team, fine, but you have to go before the Artnell Company Board of Directors and make your case. And for some reason, Arthur Allen decided not to do that. I don't know why. Maybe he thought he would not get the approval from the board, but he wound up reneging on the handshake deal and selling to his brother, John. So you had the threats of moving. You had the fact that the White Sox left WGN for WFLD-TV. I understand why they did it. The reasons were sound, but the technology was not there. And in fact, most Chicagoans could not get WFLD-TV.
Absolutely.
Because not only from the technical issues, until 1964, televisions did not go beyond Channel 14. So either you had to buy a new television set that could get UHF, or you had to buy a converter. And last but not least, there was the perception, which became reality, that after the social unrest of the 1960s, Comiskey Park was a, quote, dangerous place. So it's not just the fact that they lost 106 games. It was everything else around this team that made things so difficult. The encouraging thing was, unlike now, John Allen bought the team in September of 1969. He waited 1 year, and then he said, I've seen enough. Basically, in September of 1970, he fired everybody, from the field manager to the general manager to scouts to front office people. He made as clean a break as you're going to get, which is something that, again, unfortunately, Jerry Reinsdorf went part of the way, but not completely. At least John Allen said, we're cleaning house. We're going to try something new. 2 weeks later, he brings in Roland Heeman and he brings in Chuck Tanner, and things got better in a hurry.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a fan, Mark, I'm not sure how you could have the wisdom to think, okay, it's all going to be different. But with those changes and with that maybe cleaning house, at that point, was it wait and see? Were you cynical and said, oh, this isn't going to change anything? Or did you have some hope? Did you see the
I was only 15. I was still a White Sox, you know, a big White Sox fan. They were a big part of my life. So I had hope because I was not old enough to get jaded, to be honest with you, to be perfectly frank. And then the other thing, as Lee pointed out, they brought in Harry Carey. And again, no disrespect to Bob Elson, God rest his soul, but it was a different environment. What Bob did in the 1950s simply did not resonate in 1970 as far as how you broadcast the game. They brought in Harry Carey, who provided a great deal of excitement as well. I mean, who could forget going to the center field bleachers every Wednesday afternoon of a home
season? I used to carry beer to Harry in the center field bleachers in 1972. And he'd run out of all staff, and we'd have to take more out there.
Harry would drink a beer an inning, and if the game went into extra innings, you never knew what he was going to say.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, I don't even remember that.
So, yeah, I still had hope. I had hope because I was young and because the White Sox made a radical change. Mm-hmm. Basically, everybody in the old guard was let go. Okay.
And then the new guys were not afraid to go further. I mean, the hugest thing, the biggest thing that Tanner did immediately, other than change the, we talk about culture now, but having different attitude about what was going on, mm-hmm. was switching Wilbur Wood. Mm. one of the best relievers in the league and saying, you know, you could probably throw that knuckleball a couple hundred times a game and you ain't even going to get tired.
Do you know the making story, him a starter. The story behind that?
No.
Joe Harlan broke his leg in the last exhibition game before the White Sox were set to go to Oakland to open the season with that bizarre regularly scheduled opening day doubleheader. And Chuck, because I got this from Chuck, I did a long interview with Chuck before he passed away. Chuck and Johnny Sain got together and thought, okay, we need another starter now because Joe is on the shelf. Actually, Joe tore up his knee. I beg your pardon. He did not break his leg. He tore up his knee sliding in a second base. So he told me they went to Wilbur. And when I interviewed Wilbur, he said the same thing. And said, basically, you know, Wilbur, you could make a lot of money if you pitch every third day. And Wilbur basically said, and I'm cleaning up the language here, give me the ball. So that's kind of that's the story behind why they went with Wilbur. You're correct. Yeah. And like Wilbur told me, he got sore. Okay. I mean, throwing the knuckleball still was a repetitive motion. It wasn't like you're throwing a 95 mile an hour fastball. But Wilbur told me, yes, he was sore, but it wasn't as sore as if he had a normal complement of pitches, and he was able to pitch sometimes every 2 days. Yeah. Heck, he pitched a doubleheader one afternoon in New York. He pitched both games.
Yep.
He started both games.
Yep.
So that's how that came about. But you're correct. That was huge because in 71, a lot of people felt he should have won the Cy Young and not Vita Blue.
Oh, for sure. And every year thereafter for a while. And, of course, the next year when they made the other giant jump is when they got Dick Allen. Yeah. So, and I swear that when Dick Allen hit the ball, it went flat on one side. I've never seen a ball hit as hard as I wish they had the radar back then to measure exit velocity for him because it was absolutely astounding. I want to where are we headed from this? Because I got to get my one story in.
Please.
Well, this is a good time to get a story in. Yes.
It's a Bill Veeck story, but it's in the 70s. But it's after things got a little better. But Bill Veeck's second time. And this goes to Mark. You wrote a piece this week, one of your Today in History, was saying that it was a Kansas City game in 77 where na-na-na-na, the steam song became the theme.
It actually started at times in 76, but okay. It became a factor in 77 because of the Southside Hitmen.
All right. Well, that ties in to, because I'm talking about 77. Specifically, I think, I don't remember the date, so I went back and looked up scores, and I think it had to be July 31st of 1977.
Kansas City.
And the Sox were playing a doubleheader against Kansas City. I was working radio and TV in the South Bend Elkhart area. Came up for it with my girlfriend at the time. And it was a hot day, a hot August day, so the beer was flowing. Regular doubleheader, extra innings in the first game. They went 10 innings, and naturally it's a walk-off if the home team wins. So a lot of excitement. We were two sections toward first base from the press box and the upper deck, fairly far up the upper deck. And at one point, this big to-do comes in the section between us and the press box. And everybody starts looking over, and these big dudes, four or five large guys, I don't know if they're steel workers or what, but I mean, big guys, they're at it. I mean, they are slugging and they are pushing and they are shoving. It's not just shoving, they're swinging. And out of the side of the press box, there's a little door on the side of the press box that can be seen. Out of that door came a geriatric man with one leg.
Bill Veeck.
Bill Veeck came out and we're going, what? And waded into it. And within seconds, Veeck went flying one direction. And his glasses went flying another. And by that time, finally, the security guys show up. They cuff these ruffians and haul them off. And people pick up Veeck. Somebody found his glasses and gave them to him. And he just went right back into the press box. And after the game, A reporter asked him, "Why the hell did you do that? You could have gotten killed." And he said, "They were ruining the game for our fans. I couldn't let them do that."
That's Bill.
Imagine not just the current owner, but any owner today doing that. But that was my Bill Veeck moment, and I thought, I'm going to love that guy forever. Mm,
that is true. Mark has made a good case for 1968 not being the worst year ever. 1970 not right, being that, the worst that, year well, to be a
yeah,
White
68, Sox 69. To me, it was 1970.
So we're going to find out what maybe the worst year to be a White Sox fan is. Lee has promised a surprise twist. I'll be curious to know what Mark thinks, and I'm curious mm-hmm. to see how I'll decide because I'm flipping a coin between two. We're going to take a break, come back, and talk about that in the second half. Yeah, it's the title of the podcast, and we're getting to it a half hour in. Hey, you've sat this long. Sit another half hour and hang with us and find out what the worst year to be a White Sox fan is. Hang with us for a minute, and we promise we'll be back and talk specifically about the title of this podcast.
Let me close the door. Let me close my door, guys. I'll be right back.
All right.
Just give me a second right here.
Okay. I'll put back forcing the edit.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Okay, our doors are shut. Our studios are airtight. We are back in the second half of this podcast. Welcome. My name is Brett Valentini. I'm with the Duty Geezer of Southside Sox, etc. Lee Allen and our historian, the guy responsible for our day in history that you read every single day, even in the off season, because you know what? History just doesn't stop once the season does. And the season stopped what feels like about 6 months ago for the White Sox this year. So enjoy that all off season as well. That's Mark Liptak. I am hosting this podcast, which if you are watching, we're going to throw another banner up. And indeed, the second half, we are talking about the worst year to be a White Sox fan. 2023 is in the running.
Absolutely.
Does it win?
Competitive.
We are going to find out a surprise twist answer from Lee Allen. I'm going to go to Mark Liptak first, and I would like to know what Mark's worst year. He might not have lived through it. I mean, some of this is speculative, but the challenge of the question is not necessarily what history says, like they went on and had a decade of losing seasons or a player surprisingly retired or whatever, but at the time, like we're feeling right now, that weight of being a White Sox fan in 2023, it's heavy. So 2023 does rank, no doubt, high on this list, whether it's your number one. But I'm curious to know what your speculative worst year to be a White Sox fan is, Mark.
You could make a case for right after the Black Sox scandal, but the problem is there's no one alive today that you can talk to get a gut reaction from the fan base at the time. There's newspaper accounts, of course, but that can only tell you so much. So for that reason, I would not consider that the absolute worst season. Excuse me. And you can make a case for this year simply because they were supposed to, quote unquote, contend, although there were many people in the offseason, including members of the media, that said it would be a stretch. A lot would have to go right, especially because of their lack of depth to, quote unquote, contend. So I think that, you know, I could see it. I could see 2023. But to me, again, I go back to 1970 because it was bad on the field. The perception of the organization was bad. The ballpark was falling apart. The media basically had become Cub-centric in Chicago. The neighborhood issue, again, the perception, Comiskey's in a bad neighborhood. You're taking your life if you try and go down there. There were so many outside factors. So to me, not only because of what happens on the field, it's what happens surrounding it. To me, it's 1970. Close, but to me, it's 1970 because of all those factors.
Yeah, and it wasn't an isolated year. We're talking about now a third straight year where it's just like, right. What are these guys even doing? It's been now it's a losing trade. It doesn't offset 16 or whatever years of straight winning. 17. It's 3 years is starting to, well, all right, it's starting to build. So, yeah, I can see how, yeah, some real question marks would arise for sure. Okay, it could, I'm not sure if it's a gag answer. I'm sure there is some foundation behind it. I have a guess. I'm going to see if I'm right. I'm not going to reveal it. I would like to know now what Lee's worst year.
No gag, although I'd say a couple of years I had not thought of until you sent us a suggestion just a few hours before we did the cash. I said, here are a few hours. You went to 1929, I'd never thought of. You said it started seven straight losing seasons. Yep. Like, that's different. we're kind of used to that. But I thought, you know, they only won 59 games in 1929. Season ends beginning of October. Mm-hmm. A few weeks later,
yeah,
the market crashes and the Great Depression comes in. I'm thinking overall that was a very bad year to be a White Sox fan or any other fan.
Yep.
But that was not my answer. I had not thought of that one at all. Right. And in 1932, when the Sox only won 49 games, that obviously led to FDR being elected and things turning around a little bit very, very gradually.
And let's not forget, let me add in, Lee, in both of those years you just cited, not that this is how we define our fandom, but
I wasn't there. I want to point this out.
Cubs are in the World Series both of those years. So that's just going to add a little bit more.
It's even worse.
The White Sox, for sure. Okay, so those two are established in the list, for sure. Lee Allen's answer is, however.
Now, notice this is not the worst season to be a White Sox fan. It is the worst year to be a White Sox fan. And it does not. You did not specify that you realized at that moment. You did not say that.
Okay.
I mean, you just said it a few minutes ago, but that's unfair. You didn't say it when we were being recruited here.
Okay.
1981.
I know why.
I know why he's saying that too.
I think it was January 8th. Was 18th. The magic?
18th.
Okay. I'm close enough.
Why would that be, Lee?
I know exactly where he's going with this and why he is saying
that. Yes, of course you do. All right. And you could add, it could be 1980-81 because it was 1980 that the owners rejected the attempt by Bill Beck, great baseball man, but didn't have the money. Once he was responsible in large part for promoting free agency and then couldn't afford it. But 1980, of course, they turned down the sale to Eddie DeBartolo, who went on to be one of the most successful sports franchise owners in history with the 49ers.
And the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Just a marvelous sports guy who kind of got out of the way and let the professionals do it. But instead, in 1981, a group headed by some guy named Reinsdorf, became the owners of the White Sox. And that really was the beginning of the end. We didn't necessarily realize it at the time, but many things happen that you don't realize at the time or the beginning of the end. So that's my year.
As a personal White Sox fan, it would be my year only. Well, you've cited many good reasons, Lee, but also because of the signing of Carlton Fisk. Chet Lemon, my guy, got his, you know, nose bent out of joint because, you know, it was yep. it was too much money given to him. He sort of reneged on an agreement to re-sign with the White Sox and probably maybe end up being a lifetime White Sox player. Very minor reason, but broke my young.
Of course, that was also a strike year. Just to that's the one where the strike was in the middle of the season.
Yeah.
And I'm just saying the White Sox did not have a bad year. Yeah. As it went, they were actually two games over 500 when you added the two halves mm-hmm. of it put together. They had a good first half and terrible second half, I think is how it went. But anyhow, that's my year, and that's why I pick it.
The thing about that ownership, Lee, Jerry Reinsdorf originally was part of a group that was trying to get the New York Mets. Eddie Einhorn was originally part of a group that was trying to get a hold of the San Diego Padres. And when DeBartolo's bid was turned down by Commissioner Bowie Kuhn and the other owners, basically that was kind of a consortium. Baseball put those two guys together just to try and get the franchise sold. I talked with Mike Vec, I did a long interview with Mike many years ago, and I asked him how his dad reacted to that. And he said basically his dad did what was needed to be done to try and keep the franchise solvent in Chicago. And the sense that I got from that, and I'm not trying to put words in Mike's mouth, was that the Vec family was not exactly endeared to the fact that Bill could not get his wishes done. He wanted DeBartolo, and that was just not going to be allowed to happen.
Mark,
that's so ironic because the excuse that they gave was, well, because he's been involved with horse racing and that's gambling and we can't have that. And now every damn team has its own casino.
Right. Well, and the other reason this was not said out loud a lot, but it was there. Edward DeBartolo Sr. was of Italian heritage. And there were concerns that, let's say, he had associations with members of certain families that were not exactly above reproachment. And that factored into the decision as well. Now, whether those allegations were true, I have no idea, but they were out there.
How ironic that among many of the owners voting on this and voting this down was George Steinbrenner.
Exactly.
Just wonderful to realize that. Exactly. Mark, I have a question because I learned this not long ago, and I don't know if there is validation to it. I remember the excitement of DeBartolo coming in, and once Vec knew he had that backing, the White Sox started spending.
Yes.
But the wrinkle that I didn't really realize, and I don't know if this is actually backed up, was that Vec was going to sell, but he was going to be kept on in an advisory role, like maybe a president of the team role by DeBartolo, and he would still be associated with the team, just not as owner. Is there any validity to that? Because that seems like at least something.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Makes it extra heartbreaking.
And you're talking about when Vec got the backing of DeBartolo, mm-hmm. he went out and signed Ron LaFleur. Mm-hmm. He went out and signed Jim Essien as free agents. He spent $3 million. It was not his money. It was Edward DeBartolo's money.
Right.
So DeBartolo,
I was like, hey, this is a different way to be a fan. Wow.
Yeah, DeBartolo from day one was willing to say, okay, here's money.
Yeah.
Now invest it and let's get a better team.
Yeah. Well, my argument for worst year to be a White Sox fan, Lee alluded to it, and I think I would have chose it had he not outlined it so well. I'll probably choose something else, but I think it's hard to get around 1929, not imagining what it was at the time, but the team had been semi-competitive. It wasn't terrible post-Black Sox. It was definitely different and gutted, but they had winning seasons. They had losing seasons, but 1929 was a was a real drop. Of course, you got the Cubs in the World Series. You do have the seven straight losing seasons, and that really kicks the White Sox into what is like two decades of pretty much abysmal baseball. There were some winning seasons, but they were rare, like a handful, four maybe from 30 to 50 or so. And because even as a White Sox fan, I'm an optimist enough, if I really was pressed, I would still choose that because I don't want to believe we're headed for something worse in 2023. But my answer is going to be, and what I thought was going to be, my answer right off was going to be 2023. 1929 came in there at the end, but I'm going to still argue for 2023. We're in an utterly hopeless place. We have replaced one general manager with another who probably has less track record and competence than the general manager fired in Rick Hahn. This team was maybe bumbling in its front, well, not maybe, but in its front office leadership. I would argue that amoral was maybe not part of it. And then there's a lot of people, especially, again, younger fans who are cynical enough to be like, hey, why are you saying one billionaire is better than the other? You know, OK, eat the rich. I get it. But you know what? We can split hairs and say that the White Sox rarely, if ever, sure, Jose Canseco was on the team. Sure, they did actually sign or trade for Brett Myers. OK, it didn't last long. Adding Mike Clevinger to this team, jumping the market to get Mike Clevinger, probably now keeping Mike Clevinger and probably extending Mike Clevinger, which I got to think is somewhat likely with this.
You really think well, that's not our subject, but I'm hoping that he'll turn it down. So then go
elsewhere. We can hope, but they couldn't trade him for free. So I'm just not sure he has the market.
If he turns it down, the White Sox are going to be calling me to see if I could throw some innings.
Exactly. Please start limbering up because we are going to need you, Mark.
Pitching.
Yes,
none
it is going to be
other than one or two guys.
It is going to be Kevin Hickey.
We have nothing. We have a great center fielder.
And again, let's not forget there's a shooting in the ballpark. Whatever how were the genesis of this shooting? It seems to be way up in the air. There was somebody shot, not killed, I get it, but shot at the ballpark.
Yes.
There's so little to be excited. And I'm running a White Sox site. You guys are writing for a White Sox site. I don't want to be saying these things or feeling these things and admitting that, close to 50 years into fandom, I'm at my lowest point and it really is hopeless because I want to be told I'm wrong as of April Fool's Day. Or May 1st, I want to be told, man, all your hand wringing and all your ninning behavior and talk all off season was all for naught, Brett. You're foolish. I want to be proven wrong here, but I sense that things are going to be worse. I've been on record now already on podcast saying they are going to break 1970. They are going to lose 107 or more this year, especially in the climate of we've seen more teams losing these huge bunch of games in the last 10, 20 years than we've seen immediately preceding. Not that there weren't bad teams. I know I'm aware of the Mets and et cetera.
But there was less intentional tanking until fairly recently.
Mm-hmm. And you can imagine the White Sox going into the season saying, yeah, we're going to do it. And about 2 weeks in saying, uh-oh. And I don't think even they're naive and silly enough to think that they're going to compete this year. But their public statements, what else are they going to say? But their public statements.
They're trying to sell tickets.
Good luck with that. But I mean, okay. And they clearly haven't made moves yet. We could see them in the offseason. Moves that indicate rebuild, certainly not picking up Tim Anderson and a couple others would indicate that youth movement or whatever this is. But as Lee already pointed out, top of this podcast, what youth movement can you have? There ain't no youth. So again, it's an abyss. It's dark. It's bleak. I want to believe I'm wrong about it. I want to believe the Sox are just one weird free agent signing or one coaching staff addition to turning this all around. But I think we all know better than that and that it's going to get really rough before it gets better. So I'm afraid we're at the skirt of one of these 1929 stretches.
Just don't talk so loud because my wife might overhear you and then I'm going to get even more of these questions.
Look, I'll give you one hopeful comment.
Please.
Maybe you want to end on a hopeful note.
Okay.
Remember the movie Oh God, starring George Burns?
Come on, there's the natural too. We know that.
And George Burns as God says, The last miracle I did was the 1969 New York Mets. Before that, you got to go back to the Red Sea. So maybe in a fluke, I mean, that's why, seriously, I'm not trying to be facetious. That's why you play the game.
Yeah.
Because anything can happen. But realistically, folks, it's a long, long shot. Mm-hmm. Unless they do a lot of drastic things in the offseason to try and get some talent and such. And unfortunately, the free agent market this year isn't the greatest.
Mm-hmm. It's lousy. And, of course, they're keeping a manager who has proven himself inept, as well as promoting the general manager guy who had 7 years proving himself inept.
If I could make a prediction, it would be if the White Sox get off to a bad start, Grifol will be fired by Memorial Day.
Okay. Quick firing. Okay.
That would be my guess.
Okay. Yeah. And unlike as I think Mark had pointed out, the clearing house that we saw John Allen do is clearly not happening here, even if we have this type of season where Grifol maybe does get fired early. Well, is Getz going quickly too? It would take a catastrophic, which we don't want to live through. I don't want to be further embarrassed by this team. If it's a means to an end, I suppose I'll go through it, but it's not going to be fun. It's going to make 2024 maybe the worst year in history to be a White Sox fan. But it's just the idea that we could get that Hail Mary, we could get that miracle, all this convergence of things that would need to happen, including front office. This isn't just player level or front office level, but it's the totality of the organization makes it frustrating to the point of dishonesty, really. All right, I'm afraid this is a heavy podcast. It's a dark podcast. If it wasn't raining when you started listening or watching, it is raining now above you. You know it. Look out the window. You know it is. So apologies for that. So we do have to probably end on maybe a grimmer note, but maybe it will be hopeful because people have surprised me. I've been on record already saying the White Sox will lose 107 games next year. I would like to know from Lee and Mark what your prediction, very early lock, can change. Of course, we don't know anything about personnel, et cetera, but put on the spot now in this podcast, which I'm doing to you right now. Tell me, how many games the White Sox will lose next year?
I'm going to be very, very optimistic. Everything will turn correctly exactly the way it possibly can. Okay. There will be rebound years from the guys who are bad this year. There will be no regression from the guys who have been good. And you are wrong, Brett. They are only going to lose 105.
I knew it. Okay. All right. Slightly more optimistic. Now, Mark, you almost can't be more pessimistic than that. Where are you?
No, I can't. They will lose over 90 games next year, but I think they will lose more along the lines of 95.
Okay.
Because I think they have no choice. They're going to have to bring in some people this winter. And how bad can those guys be considering what they already have? So I'm a little bit optimistic that they will perform a little better on the field. Because remember, guys like Yoan Moncada, this is his contract year.
That's true.
He's a free agent after this upcoming season. He's just one of a bunch of guys. Contract years are big incentives for guys suddenly not to sit out four games because they foul a ball off their big toe.
Didn't work very well for Tim Henderson.
That will influence some of these guys, and they will play better. But they're still going to lose a lot of games, Brett.
Yeah.
It's going to be 2025 at the earliest.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you say, you know, it's almost got to get better, well, you know, I would say just take a seat and just watch because,
sure.
I mean, there is that chance, but boy, it does seem to be tipping the other way. Now, whatever the actual number is, I mean, the idea that our most sunny prediction is 95 losses means 2024 is going to enter this list for next year. So when we all gather together a year from now, guys, and talk about the worst year ever to be a White Sox fan, you've had time to think about it even further. And Mark can revise his 1970 answer because it's like, holy cow, what did I just live through? And Lee will come up with another good punchline joke of a year, which unfortunately does resonate pretty sickeningly. I mean, we don't want to think of that because 1991 actually was on the field sort of an exciting year for White Sox fans.
Yes, it was.
Boy, long term. Yeah. Oh, gosh, grim and getting grimmer by the day, which is a great note to end this podcast. You know, we talk about White Sox history. It's usually, it has been, we've kept it pretty Sonny, this is probably the grimmest of the history podcasts we've had. I can't promise they won't be grim in the future because, you know, 120 plus years, there's been some rough times and we really did have to address this. It was sort of triggered by Lee's article, which actually had an optimistic tone. The problem is the blueprint that he sort of laid out or basically just parroted because of what actually happened in 1970, it's just really going to be impossible to duplicate. Mark has a little bit of hope that guys are going to be introduced into this organization that are going to drag the team all the way up to only 95 losses, which is a start because then maybe the next year it's 90. It's the same way. It's like the reverse rebuild where it's like suddenly they're 500 in 6 or 7 years, but it may be a bleak era ahead. I hope not. And I hope I have a lot more fun history to talk about and maybe even fun present times about regarding the White Sox with these two here. Lee Allen and Mark Liptak, thank you for joining me on this.
Thanks, Brett.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you for your debut history podcast, Lee. And we'll be back. We'll be back soon, Mark. When he finally carves some time in between basketball and football and women's basketball and volleyball, he'll find some time to talk some history with me, and we'll do another one of these real soon. But thanks, everybody, for listening, watching, reading, all that stuff. We know it's a grim time, a tough time to be a White Sox fan. Trust me, no one feels that weight as heavily as the three folks looking at you or talking to you on this podcast, but still we are White Sox fans and we will be as 2024 comes around. Thanks everybody for listening, watching, and for my two guests for being with us. We'll be back with more history and other podcasts. Oh gosh, I'm sure, definitely sure, sooner than you are ready for us.